From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Happy New Year. On today's Fresh Air, we conclude our week-long encore series featuring our favorite music interviews of 2002. We'll hear from one of the biggest pop hitmakers of the 70s and early 80s, Barry Manilow. And we'll meet one of the true eccentrics of pop music, Tom Waits. He'll tell us why he wanted to look and sound like an old man when he was a young man. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The new year marks the start of new laws, including the federal law that requires the checking of each piece of airline passenger luggage for explosives. The Transportation Security Administration says that more than 90% of baggage is now being checked electronically, with the rest being examined by hand by matching the luggage with passengers or by explosive-sniffing dogs. Security experts say the first real test of the new system will come tomorrow when holiday travelers head home. Parents whose children are stuck in dangerous schools will get a new option starting today. Under the federal education law, No Child Left Behind, states will be required to identify which schools are violent and give students the chance to transfer out. NPR's Robert Smith reports.
Each state must come up with its own definition for what's considered a persistently dangerous school. For students at such schools or children who are victims of violent crime, the school district has to offer the option to transfer to a safer school in the same district. There are many catches to the new law. The safe schools have to have room for the new students. The students can't transfer out of the district, and parents will have to pay for transportation to get to the new school. The difficult part now is that states have to come up with objective definitions for what's considered dangerous. In Minnesota, for instance, a violent school would have to have at least 1% of the student body expelled for weapons or assault offenses. In North Carolina, a dangerous school would be one that's had 5 or more violent crimes per 1,000 students. Robert Smith, NPR News.
Brazil's first elected leftist president, Luiz Lula da Silva, took the oath of office today. Thousands of working-class supporters came to the capital to cheer him on. Amy Radel reports from Rio de Janeiro.
Lula, as he's known, grew up poor to become a union leader and founder of the Workers' Party. He won the presidency in a landslide election in October. In Brasilia, Lula took office saying job creation and combating hunger will be his top priorities. If by the end of my term every Brazilian has the chance to eat breakfast, lunch, and dinner, I will have fulfilled my life's mission, he said. Cuban President Fidel Castro and Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez attended Lula's swearing-in, along with other Latin American leaders. Lula told them his top foreign policy priority will be fighting the trade barriers of developed countries. He also pledged to work toward a South America that is politically stable, prosperous, and united. For NPR News, I'm Amy Radel in Rio de Janeiro.
Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez traveled to Brazil today for the inauguration. Chavez left behind a country in the grips of a month-long general strike that has paralyzed the economy. Chavez told reporters he believes the strike is a conspiracy by wealthy business interests to overthrow his anti-corruption government. The strike has virtually shut down Venezuela's oil imports. This is NPR News. Palestinian lawyers said today they'll ask a court to overturn Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat's appointment of a new attorney general. The lawyers say the appointment violates the Palestinian constitution. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports.
Yasser Arafat recently ratified a law for an independent judiciary. According to the law, an independent council of judges is meant to make court appointments. But last week, Arafat defied that law and appointed Khaled al-Hijra, a close associate, as attorney general, and the lawyers said they will fight to have that decision overturned. Arafat is under pressure to reform the Palestinian Authority and fight corruption, but his critics say he does not want to relinquish any power. Palestinian human rights groups say there has been no judicial reform. Meanwhile, Palestinian officials meet later this month to discuss a permanent constitution that will take effect when a Palestinian state is established. Linda Gradstein, NPR News. Jerusalem.
Michigan's new governor took office today. Jennifer Granholm is the state's first female governor, taking over a post that's previously been held by 44 men. In her inaugural address, the new chief executive promised to focus on the themes that got her elected, including education, the environment, unemployment, and the cost of prescription drugs. Granholm has said her first priority will be to address Michigan's impending budget deficit, which could reach almost $2 billion in the next fiscal year. The governor is required to submit a budget plan to the state legislature by the middle of March. Elsewhere in the country, George Pataki began his third term as governor of New York, and Bill Richardson took office as governor of New Mexico. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, maker of cholesterol-free vegetable oil, ADM, the nature of what's to come, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Happy New Year. Today we conclude our Encore Week, featuring our favorite music interviews from 2002. First, we hear from one of the most successful pop performers of the 70s and early 80s, Barry Manilow. He had 25 top 40 hits between 1974 and 83, including Mandy, I Write the Songs, Trying to Get the Feeling Again, Looks Like We Made It, Daybreak, Can't Smile Without You, Copacabana, and I Made It Through the Rain. Before he started writing and singing pop songs, he wrote commercial jingles, and he was Bette Midler's first music director. He stopped recording his own songs in the 80s. There didn't seem to be much interest in them anymore. But recently, he moved back onto the pop charts with his Best Of compilation, Ultimate Manilow. And in 2002, he had a new CD of original songs called Here at the Mayflower. I spoke with him last March. When I picked up your Ultimate Manilow record, the Greatest Hits record, I looked at the songs on the back and I thought, well, I know that one. Don't know this one. But when I played it, I realized that I knew the ones that I didn't think I knew. I just didn't remember them by title.
Oh, I have insinuated my little self into your brains over the last 20 years.
But that's the thing. I mean, you know, your songs were everywhere. I mean,
they were
on the radio, they were on TV, they were in stores and probably in elevators. I mean, they were just
Were in elevators. I'm sure they were in elevators, yes. Well, no, it's true. And, you know, I hadn't even listened to these records. You know, I sing them nightly, but they're not, you know, they don't sound exactly like the old records did. And I actually, somebody was playing it, and I actually listened to it, and they all sound pretty good. I mean, you know, Weekend in New England sounds pretty good even, you know, all these years later.
What are some of the most unusual places you've heard your songs?
That's a great question. Some of the most unusual places. Well, you know, well, I must say that, you know, I have heard it in restaurants and unusual places. I don't know, you know, in big stadiums and of course, in, you know, boutiques and you know, karaoke bars. That was pretty awful. I must say,
tell me a karaoke story.
It was some very bad singer trying to do I Write the Songs. I had to leave.
Well, what were you doing there in the first place? Why were you in a karaoke bar?
I didn't know it was a karaoke bar. It was a Mexican restaurant, and then suddenly somebody got up and sang. I hope they didn't know that I was there.
That's really funny. The funny thing about I Write the Songs, you know, people associate that song with you because you recorded it, but you didn't write I Write the Songs.
I did not. And I knew it was going to get me in trouble as soon as Clive showed. You know, my hit record experience is all, I give the credit to Clive Davis, who was the president of Arista while I was there. And when I went on to Arista Records, I really knew nothing about pop music at all. My first single was Could It Be Magic, a song that I based on a Chopin prelude, and it came in at 8 minutes long. So what did I know about pop music? So, you know, you're supposed to have a 3-minute record. But when Clive started to work with me, he actually taught me the ins and outs of how to have a hit record. And he would submit songs to me so that I would arrange and produce and sing these outside pieces of material, even though I considered myself a songwriter. And I Write the Songs was one of the ones he gave me, and I knew I was going to get in trouble if I accepted this, because first of all, I figured everybody was going to think that I was screaming about how I write all the songs in the world. What does he think he is, Burt Bacharach? You know? And then I didn't write I Write the Songs, but Bruce Johnson of the Beach Boys wrote it, and when I sang it, I knew what he was trying to get to. He's saying the spirit of music is really the creator of everything, you know, of all composers' work. And I believe that, too. I believe that when I'm writing, I have nothing to do with it. I'm just taking dictation. I loved that idea, but I didn't think anybody listening to I Write the Songs would really understand that. And I was right. Most people actually thought that I was singing about myself. And it didn't seem to bother anybody either, but it's true. I didn't write I Write the Songs.
Why don't we hear a little bit of I Write the Songs?
I write the songs that make the whole world sing. I write the songs of love and special things. I write the songs that make the young girls cry. I write the songs.
That's Barry Manilow, and it's one of his hits that's included on the new CD, Ultimate Manilow. Let's talk about your early musical life. Your first instrument was, I think, accordion?
I'm sorry.
What happened?
Yeah. I'm sorry that it was the accordion.
Oh, you're sorry that it was the accordion? Oh.
Yeah.
Why do you have
yes,
to apologize?
I'm guilty. Yes, I'm guilty that it was the accordion.
Well, the accordion is like the hippest instrument now. I don't have to tell you that. You
know? Not when I play it.
Not when you played it. The whole Lady of Spain bit?
Yeah, I think every Jewish and Italian boy cannot get out of Brooklyn, New York unless he learns how to play the accordion. There's a guard at the Brooklyn Bridge, and you have to play Lady of Spain before you can go over the bridge. Everybody I knew played the accordion badly. I happened to, you know, because I was more musical than the rest of my friends, I kind of got through Havana Gila and Lady of Spain, and I was... I actually entertained my relatives. You know, they just thought it was the greatest thing. It really wasn't the thing that turned my musical motor on, I can tell you. But you're right. There are people who play the accordion and actually make it sound good. I was not one of those people.
Did you sing when you played?
No, I never sang. I didn't sing until I started making records. I never really thought of myself as a singer. Singing was for other people to do. Right. Performing was for other people to do. I was... If I was going to have a career in music at all, it was going to be as a musician, and that was it. No, I never sang.
When you first started working professionally, I think it was in more of a supporting role, working like you had an act with a woman singer. I think Jeannie was her name.
Yes.
And so you did some arranging for her. You were the pianist. You sang some duets with her. But it was kind of, it sounds from your book like it was a kind of supporting role. Did you see yourself as being like a supporting role type of character in music?
Well, if I saw myself at all in music, and like I said, it was so risky, I never even dreamed about even that. But if I were to imagine myself in the music business at that time, it would have been in a supporting role, as an arranger, as a pianist, as a producer, as a songwriter. Those were my goals. Those were my dreams. Those were my fantasies, that one day, if I ever took the risk, that's where I would wind up. And so my first professional engagement was as an accompanist for many, many singers, and Jeannie was one of them.
Well, your most famous position in a supporting role was as Bette Midler's accompanist and music arranger, and this was in the era when she was playing at the Continental Baths, the gay steam bath in Manhattan. How did you meet Bette Midler?
Well, she was one of the dozens of girl and boy singers that I was accompanying. I had left CBS, and I had begun accompanying singers, and I was making a really healthy living. Because I'm really a good accompanist. I'm not that great a pianist, but I'm a really good accompanist. And they are always in demand in New York for auditions and people who need arranging and coaching and stuff. So before I knew it, I was coaching just about every singer that needed a pianist. I was booked like 12 hours a day. And Bette must have heard of me and called me and asked if I would play a couple of weekends for her at this place called the Continental Bath. So I worked for a couple of weekends for her. I subbed for her, the piano player that she had. And she exploded and asked me if I would stay along with her. And I, frankly, didn't want to just work for one person. And she couldn't afford to, you know, really just, you know, pay me for, you know, 24 hours a day. But Bette Midler was so incredibly talented that I just could not say no. And I began to work for her exclusively.
Could you talk a little bit about what it was like to play to an audience in a gay steam bath?
Well, I only worked there for 2 weekends. You know, people got, there's this unbelievable reputation that both Bette and I had, you know, about working in, you know, all the gay bathhouses of all around the world, you know, in Iran and Paris. But it really was, I don't know how long she worked there, but I know for me it was only 2 weekends. And it was a nightclub situation there, although they were in towels, but it was a nightclub situation. And there was a stage and lights and a sound system. And Bette would come out and do her brilliant hour and a half. And they would freak out. And after the 2 weekends, she got booked at a place called the Upstairs at the Downstairs, which was in Manhattan. And that was it. That was the end of my experience at the Continental Baths. But a lot of other people worked at the baths because it was, like I said, it was a really interesting nightclub situation. And the audiences were fantastic to the performers.
My guest is Barry Manilow. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Barry Manilow. He was one of the biggest pop hit makers of the 70s and early 80s. Here's his first big hit, Mandy.
I remember all my life, raining down as cold as ice, shadows of a man, a face through a window, crying in the night. The night goes into morning, just another day. Happy people pass my way. Looking in their eyes, I see a memory. I never realized how happy you made me. Oh, Mandy, well, you came and you gave without taking, but I sent you away. Oh, Mandy, well, you kissed me and stopped me from shaking.
Did you think, well, I'm gonna be the one by the microphone. I'm gonna be the one singing. I'm gonna have my own act. What led you to that point?
You know, it felt to me, still seems to me that I was not in charge of that until way, way into my career. It felt like I was just catching up because when this opportunity to sing for myself came up, I was very reluctant to pursue this. I, first of all, didn't believe that I had any right to be a singer. I didn't think that I had a voice. I didn't think that I had a style. I didn't think that, and frankly, it wasn't anything that I'd ever aspired to. Anyway, I was still trying to come from that old Tin Pan Alley school where you wrote songs for other people to record. But I got this record offer, a contract offer, because somebody had heard my demos that I had sung. I had sung my own songs. And I was trying to get other people to record them, but I couldn't afford other singers, so I sang them myself. And I got an offer to make a record because Bell Records thought that I don't know what they thought. They liked what they heard. And I was so interested in promoting my own songs that if that was the only way to do it, I took it. But they said that I could not, they wouldn't give me this deal unless I promised to go out and put a show together and promote it. Well, that I just didn't know how to do that. But I was still conducting for Bette, and I asked her if I could sing a few songs to open her second act. And in that way, I would tour to promote my album, and I would also stay a music director for her show. And she let me do it. So I would conduct her first act, then I would open her second act with 3 of my songs from this new album that I had made, and then I would continue to conduct it. So that kind of worked out great.
Were you the first person to record one of your own songs?
Yeah, I was. Yes, I was. I was the first person to record one of my own songs. If you don't want to count, State Farm is there.
Is that one of your commercials?
Yeah.
Yeah, because you wrote a lot of jingles before you made it as a performer.
Yeah, I did.
Oh, so how does the whole thing go? What's the first line in that? In the State Farm
what,
is
like
there.
A good neighbor? Yeah. State Farm is there, yeah.
Oh, wow. You
know, a very talented girl named Leslie Miller recorded that one after I wrote it, and then there was another one called I Am Stuck on Band-Aids and a Band-Aid Stuck on Me, and there was a whole batch of little kids that recorded that. But, I mean, you know, I wouldn't consider that was, you know, my first hit, you know.
Well, let me back up to that. How did you start writing commercials? You know, we've got you going from Bette Midler's music director to recording demos and recording yourself. Where do the commercials fit in?
Well, when I was sending my demos out, a commercial agent heard some of these demos, and they thought that I was writing commercially. And they called me and said, do you want to go up for a Dodge commercial? And I said, sure. So I wrote a Dodge commercial, the melody to the lyric that they gave me. And because my commercial, not knowing anything, came in like, you know, at 4 minutes or something. You're supposed to write it for 30 seconds. You know, and but they liked the melody, and ultimately, as we pared the whole thing down to 30 seconds, I got it. I got the first one I went up for, and then they kept calling me to write various jingles, and State Farm and Band-Aids are the ones that people still remember.
Now, what did you learn about the craft of songwriting from writing commercial jingles?
Well, I attended the New York College of Music, and a little while I went to Juilliard, and even though that was a pretty good training for my brains, the commercial world, my 3 years in the commercial world was really the college that I went to, because I got to work with the top musicians. You know, they pay so well. You work with the top studio musicians who taught me really how to arrange music. You know, the oboe player would say, psst, come on over here. You see this thing? You're writing it too high. I'd say, really? I'm writing it too high? Yeah. The oboe can't go up that high, so take it down an octave. This would go on and on. I worked with the great, great studio singers who taught me how to harmonize and how to change the timbre of my voice. I worked with these great engineers who you know, I would stand behind, and I would see how they made these jingles sound so hot that they would jump out of the radio. And as far as the songwriting goes, well, you're up against so many fantastic songwriters that you've got to write the catchiest melody in 30 seconds. If you don't write it, if you don't write the best one, then the other guys get it. And so for 3 years, I was in school, and I'll never, never forget that.
Now, did you ever come up with a hook for a jingle and think, wait a minute, that's really a song. It's not a jingle. I'm keeping that one for myself.
A lot of them. But, you know, once you start to write 30-second jingles, they really don't want to be much more than 30-second jingles.
Uh-huh. So, like, there were ideas coming to you that you knew were just, like, 30-second ideas.
Yeah, they're great hooks, but every time I tried to expand them, they didn't work.
Right, so there's no bridge to You Deserve a Break Today.
No, there's no bridge to You Deserve a Break, and there's no bridge to State Farm Is There. You know, I mean, State Farm Is There is such a pretty little melody, you know, that it could be a melody, but frankly, it's probably better as a commercial.
When you were having all those top 10 hits, this was the 70s and the 80s. Now, all of us who remember then know that, well, most of us were fashion victims of one sort or another during that era, particularly in the 70s. Working. There were some pretty frightening things that we all wore, that we all participated in. As a performer, I think it's even worse for performers, because performers have to wear more extreme versions of whatever.
And you're tortured with them for the rest of your life.
Yeah, like, here I am bringing it up again for you. So what are some of your worst fashion memories?
Well, you know, I looked just like Rod Stewart and Elton John did. You know, we all looked like idiots back then. You know,
I got the
glitter and the, you know, bell bottoms and the puka beads, and I frankly looked like Britney Spears back then with my long blonde hair, really, but before the boob job.
Oh, exactly. I was gonna mention
that was me.
David Rakoff did an interview with you in the Sunday New York Times Magazine.
Yeah.
And you had mentioned that the Smithsonian had asked for your, your Copacabana jacket, which you
really
described.
Isn't that funny?
Yeah, you described it as being a huge, huge ruffled Desi Arnaz Babalu kind of thing.
And it is. I did it as a joke in 1978, and, you know, and somebody took a photo of me, and, you know, from that moment on, I was sunk. I was just sunk. You know, I did it as a joke, but I think people, you know, thought that I was serious.
We said that the Smithsonian asked you for the jacket. You sent it to them, and then they sent it back to you.
Well, here's the real story is this. I just put my foot in my mouth. They asked me for the jacket, and, you know, it's such a funny jacket. It's a joke. And so when I got it, I was interviewed And the interviewer said, it's going to the Smithsonian. I said, yeah, I always knew it was going to wind up in an institution. And the Smithsonian got so insulted, they sent it back.
Oh, oh. So where is the jacket now?
Oh, it lives in my offices in Los Angeles. And it's still as silly as it ever was, but now it has a little bit more meaning for me.
Now, I have a question for you, and I know you're asked this a lot, but has it bothered you that although you've had this huge success over the years, there's also been people, you know, listeners and some critics who like use the word syrupy to describe your music, and, you know, you've been the butt of jokes and in some articles and other places. Is that difficult to handle? Does it bug you?
Now and again, it does. I'm, you know, human. So, yeah, it does. I go into self-pity for a while, and I pull the covers over my head like any human being would do. But it never really stopped me, mostly because I believe in what I do. I listen to these songs, you know, trying to get the feeling, and this one's for you, and When October Goes, and I say, well, I like them. I think they sound great. And, you know, my band likes them, and the audiences like them, and so I just keep going. I just keep doing what I love doing and hope that there's an audience out there for it. And I was always surprised at the critics when they felt they needed to be so mean-spirited in their opinions to somebody that they never even met. But I forgave them, the little creeps, for making my life miserable all those years. But, you know, the best revenge is, like I said before, you know, I continue to get the opportunity to make music, to make the music that I love to make. And so that's really the best revenge.
Our interview with Barry Manilow was recorded last March. His greatest hit CD is called Ultimate Manilow, and his CD of new original songs is called Here at the Mayflower. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, this is NPR, National Public Radio. Coming up, one of pop music's true eccentrics, Tom Waits. He'll tell us why he wanted to sound like an old man when he was a young man. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're going to conclude our Encore Week series with one of the true eccentrics of pop music, Tom Waits. Earlier this year, in the New York Times, he was described as the poet of outcasts. There's always been an element of mystery surrounding his life. The people he sings about are usually losers, hobos, outlaws, and drunks. The darkness of his lyrics is accentuated by the rumble and rasp of his voice, a voice that sounded old even when he was young. Waits has been recording since 1973. Tom Waits had two new CDs in 2002, Alice and Blood Money. Each was written for a music theater piece by Robert Wilson. Each has songs co-written with Waits' wife, Kathleen Brennan. When I spoke with Waits last May, we started with a song from Blood Money. This is Misery is the River of the World.
All that the monkey can climb, the more he shows his tail. Call no man happy till he dies. There's no milk at the bottom of the pail. God builds a church, the devil builds a chapel, like the thistles that are growing on the trunk of a tree. All the good in the world you can put inside a thimble and still have room for you and me. If there's one thing you can say about mankind, there's nothing kind about man. You can drive out nature with a pitchfork, but it always comes roaring back again. Misery's the river of the world. Misery's the river of the world. Misery's the river of the world.
Music from Tom Waits' new CD, Blood Money. Tom Waits, welcome to Fresh Air.
Oh, thanks. Thanks for having me.
The arrangements for your songs are really good. Do you do the arrangements yourself?
Well, I collaborate with my wife on the songs and every aspect of it, really, from composing and arranging and recording, all that business. So, we have a rhythm and a way of working it. It's kind of like borrowing the same $10 from somebody over and over again. when you live together, it makes it a lot easier, the payback,
What was the music that you grew up listening to because your parents were listening to it? I mean, before you were old enough to choose music yourself, what was the music in your house?
Really young mariachi music, I guess. My dad only played a Mexican radio station, and then Frank Sinatra, and later Harry Belafonte, and then I would go over to my friends' houses, and I would go into the den with their dads and find out what they were listening to. I couldn't wait to be an old man. I was about 13, I didn't really identify with the music of my own generation, but I was very curious about the music of others. And I think I responded to the song forms themselves, cakewalks and waltzes and barcaroles and parlor songs and all that stuff. I think which are just really nothing more than jello molds for music. But I seem to like the old stuff, Cole Porter and Oscars and Hammerstein and Gershwin and all that stuff. I like the melody.
Now, you said your father listened mostly to the Mexican station and to mariachi music.
Yeah.
Was your father Mexican?
No, my dad's from Texas. He grew up in a place called Sulphur Springs, Texas. And my mom's from Oregon. She listened to church music, all that, Brother Springer, all those. She used to send money into all the preachers, And but the early songs I remember was Abilene. When I heard Abilene on the radio, it really moved me. And then I heard, you know, Abilene, prettiest town I've ever seen. Women there don't treat you mean. And Abilene, I just thought that was the greatest lyric. You know, women there don't treat you mean. And then, you know, Detroit City. Last night I went to sleep in Detroit City. And I dreamed about the cotton fields back home. I liked songs with the names of towns in them, and mm-hmm. I think I liked songs with weather in them, and something to eat. So I feel like there's a certain anatomical aspect to a song that I respond to. I think, oh, yeah, I can go into that world. There's something to eat. There's the name of a street. There's a, okay, yeah, there's a saloon, okay. So I think probably that's why I put things like that in my songs.
When you started listening to older music and relating to that, did other things accompany that, like a certain way of dressing or speaking or behaving?
Oh, yeah, sure. You know, I wore an old hat and I drove an old car. I bought a car for $50 from Fred Moody next door, who's from Tennessee, 55 Buick Special. You know, it's a AM radio in there. I guess, yeah, sure. You know, I walked with a cane. You know, I was really, I was going overboard, perhaps. But
What kind of cane is it?
You know, a cane.
Like, no, I mean, did it have like a silver tip? I mean, how?
No, an old man's cane from a Salvation Army.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and I carved my name in it and everything.
And what did you think that added to your image?
It gave me a walk, I guess.
Uh-huh.
Gave me something distinctive. Oh, what was that guy in here earlier with a cane? Did you see that guy? It just gave me something that I liked identity-wise, I guess.
My guest is singer, songwriter, and musician Tom Waits. His latest CDs are Alice and Blood Money. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Tom Waits. His latest CDs are Alice and Blood Money. Here's a song from Blood Money called A Good Man Is Hard to Find.
Well, I always play Russian roulette in my head. 17 black or 29 red. How far from the pew, I will always remember to forget about you. Good man is hard to find, only strangers keep in my bed.
That's A Good Man Is Hard to Find from the new Tom Waits CD, Blood Money. He also has another new CD called Alice, and we'll hear some of that a little bit later. Now, I want to ask you about your voice. You have a very raspy singing voice. Was that a sound that you strove for, you know, that you worked on having, or is it what naturally developed?
It's that old man thing. I couldn't wait to be an old man. Old man with a deep voice. I scream into a pillow.
Well, you know John Mahoney, the actor.
Sure, yeah.
He told me he actually did stuff like that, that he wanted a distinctive voice. And and so he used to do these exercises that he practiced in a closet of just, like, shouting and trying to, you know, like, growl a lot. And he actually permanently did something to his vocal cords as a result of it.
Yeah, hooray. I'm all for it.
was say, Louis Armstrong an influence on you?
Oh, yeah, yeah, sure. Yeah. You know, you can't ignore the influence of someone like Louis Armstrong. It's you know, he's like a river. He's like a country to be explored in and of himself. And but yeah, he was like he came out of the ground just like a potato. You know, he's completely natural. Yeah, sure, love those tunes. And but this one, this Good Man's Hard to Find was, yeah, it was an attempt to kind of tip my hat somewhat to that.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, you actually sing in different kinds of voices on your new CDs. I mean, you have, like, your very deep, growly voice, and then a lighter voice that you use.
Yeah, well, it's just like it's just a musical vocabulary, really. Mm-hmm, you know, you find the appropriate sound for the correct tune and match them up. Yeah, you know, I like to scream, and I can croon, that stuff.
Have you ever worried about hurting your voice by?
Oh, I've heard it. Yeah, I have heard it, but I have a voice doctor in New York who used to treat Frank Sinatra and various people. He said, "Oh, you're doing fine. Don't worry about it."
Oh, that's good. Now, you once said that you wish you could have been a part of the Brill Building era in which people like Carole King and Lieber and Stoller and Ellie Greenwich and Jeff Barry were writing songs for singers and for vocal groups. What do you think you would have liked about that?
Oh, I guess writing at gunpoint sounds really exciting to me. Those kinds of deadlines. I'm into a rehearsal building on Times Square in New York one afternoon, and a really tiny little room. In fact, it was probably smaller than the room I'm in right now, which is a little larger than a phone booth. There's just enough room for a little spinet piano, and then you could just barely close the door, and there you were. And it was, and you could hear every kind of music coming to you through the walls and through the windows and underneath the door. And you heard African bands, and you heard, like, you know, comedians, and you'd hear applause every now and then, and you'd hear tap dancers, and I think I just like the whole melange of it, you know, the way it all kind of mixes together. Mm-hmm. I like turning on two radios at the same time and listen to them. I like hearing things incorrectly. I think that's how I get a lot of ideas, is by mishearing something.
Although you weren't part of the Brill Building thing, other people have recorded your songs, and I thought I'd play one of them. Johnny Cash recorded your song "Down There by the Train."
Yeah, right. That killed me. That was wild. I said, "That's it. I'm all done now." Boy, you know, Johnny Cash did a song of mine. Boy, I'm all done. Thanks very much. that was really flattering. I love the way he did it, too.
Oh, yeah. Do you know how he knew the song or why he decided to record it?
Well, a lot of people sent him tunes because he's doing this record with Rick Rubin and different people that different songwriters sent him tunes, and he just picked from them. So when someone does a tune, well, especially someone that you've been listening to since you're a kid, it's a bit of a validation. It's meaningful.
Yeah. Yeah, Johnny Cash is pretty validating when it comes to that.
Yeah, all right.
Okay, well, let's hear it. This is from Johnny Cash's American Recordings album, and this is the Tom Waits song, "Down There by the Train."
You can hear the whistle, you can hear the bell, from the halls of heaven to the gates of hell. And there's room for the forsaken if you're there on time. You'll be washed of all your sins and all of your crimes if you're down there by the train.
down there by the train, down there by the train, down there by the train, down there where the train goes slow.
That's Johnny Cash doing the Tom Waits song, Down There by the Train. My guest is Tom Waits. Did you hear anything different in that song when Johnny Cash recorded it, different from how you heard it in your head when you wrote it?
Well, he changed some stuff around. That's normal. I do the same thing when I do somebody else's tune. You really have to, you try it on, and if it's a little tighter in here, or doesn't quite close over this, you cut it, or you know, you make it fit. You want to make it sound like yours.
It's funny because that song, when he sings it, it sounds like it's like an unusual spiritual.
Oh, yeah.
And usually you write about godlessness.
Godlessness? Really?
Oh. Wouldn't you say?
Well, I don't know about that.
The absence of God?
I don't know. Do you think so?
Well, some of the songs. Yeah. Well, one of them explicitly, like, God's away on business.
Oh, okay. Well, he's away. He's not gone. He's just away. And you have to understand, he was on business. So, you know, and a guy like him has got to be busy, and he's, you know, looking after a lot of things. So,
so did you meet Johnny Cash?
No, I have not met Johnny Cash. I would look forward to that day down the road, and I would love to meet him.
Tom Waits, you have two new CDs. We heard part of Blood Money. You have another new CD called Alice, which I believe, like Blood Money, also has its origins as a Robert Wilson music theater piece.
Right, yeah. Yeah, it was done in Hamburg quite a while ago, in 93, something like that.
And what is Alice about?
It's a hypothetical situation. Kind of imagining the obsession that Lewis Carroll had for this young girl, Alice, and, you know, what it might have been like inside of his mind in Victorian England and all that stuff. The beginning of photography, and he's, you know, a young gal, and, you know, it's kind of like a, you know, fever dream or whatever, kind of a virus of the mind.
Why don't we hear the title track? This is called Alice. And if there's something you want to say to introduce it, that's great. And if not, we'll just hear it.
Yeah, this is Alice. This is kind of like the opening tune. And it's like a private moment. It's like sitting in a chair by yourself thinking about someone.
Okay, here's Alice, the title track from the new Tom Waits CD.
It's dreamy weather. We're on. You waved your crooked wand along an icy pond with a frozen moon. A murder of silhouette crows I saw and the tears on my face and the skates on the pond. Spell Alice. I disappear in your name, but you must wait for me somewhere across the sea. There's the wreck of a ship. Your hair is like meadow grass on the tide. And the raindrops on my window and the ice in my drink. Baby, all I can think of is Alice.
My guest is singer, songwriter, and musician Tom Waits. His latest CDs are Alice and Blood Money. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
My guest is singer, songwriter, and musician Tom Waits. He has two new CDs, Alice and Blood Money. Now, you dropped out of high school. Why did you drop out? Is there something that you want to do instead, or did you just hate going?
Oh, I wanted to go into the world. Mm-hmm. You know, enough of this. Mm-hmm. I didn't like the ceiling in the rooms. I didn't like the holes in the ceiling, the little tiny holes in the corkboard and the long stick used for opening the windows.
Oh, God. Yeah, we had one of those in my elementary school.
I just hated all that stuff. I was real sensitive to my visual surroundings, and I just wanted to get out of there.
Did any adults try to stop you, either your parents or teachers?
I had good teachers. I had some. My folks broke up when I was about 11, and so I had teachers that I liked a lot. I kind of looked up to, and but then they seemed like they couldn't wait to get out into the world themselves and do some, you know, banging around and learning and growing. So I thought maybe they were encouraging me to leave.
So did you succeed in kind of getting out into the world, so to speak?
Pretty much, yeah. And,
what'd you do?
Oh, yeah, I hitchhiked all over the place. And
did you ever do the street musician thing?
I didn't, but when I see people do it, I see, oh, man, I should have done that. That's how you really get your chops together, you know. Because I'm real, I guess, particular about, those things. I get real nervous. But I think I wish I had done that, because it looks like it takes a lot of guts, and I think that you probably cut through a lot of potential stage fright that you would eventually have and maybe help you down the road.
So has stage fright been an issue for you?
Oh, yeah. I go through all kinds of stuff about it. But, you know, when I get out there, I'm all right. But my first big gigs are opening the show for Frank Zappa, and I think that was difficult. I was kind of like the rectal thermometer for the audience, and it was a little awkward for me. I was alone, and I was performing in front of large groups of people, and they were verbally abusive, and I think it... I'm like a dog. I was beat as a dog. So,
is there a point in your career that you see as a turning point from getting to where you are now from where you were when you started performing?
Oh yeah, probably. Well, I got married. Really, you know? That was it. You know? I mean, that's like the most important thing I ever did. And then Kathleen really was the one that encouraged me to produce my own records. You know. And, mm-hmm.
What kind of music background is she from?
Oh, she's got, like, opera in there, and she was going to be a nun, you know, so we changed all that.
Yeah, I guess so.
But you know, she's adventurous, you know, and she kind of picks up a lot of stations that I don't pick up. I get kind of narrow and concerned in making something, give it four legs and getting it to stand up. And she's more interested in what goes inside, and which is very feminine. And I think that's what works. And the idea of going into the studio and doing your own record is kind of scary. You know, pick the engineer, pick all the musicians, and you know, write some kind of mission statement for yourself and what you want it to be and sound like and feel like, and take responsibility for everything that goes on the tape. That's a lot to do, especially it's a lot for a record company to let you do when you behave like I did. And they didn't, they thought I was, I think they thought I was a drunk, and they, you know, and I was really non-communicative, and I scratched the back of my neck a lot, and I looked down at my shoes a lot, and I wore old suits, and they were nervous about me. Once I got a taste for it, I really, really liked it.
Tom Waits, thank you so much. It's really been great to talk with you. Thank you.
Oh, we're all done.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Nice to talk to you, Terry.
Tom Waits, recorded in May after the release of his CDs, Alice and Blood Money. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer this week is Roberta Sherrock. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, Jessica Chu, and Megan Howell. Our engineers are Fred Snyder and Julian Hertzfeld. I'm Terry Gross. All of us at Fresh Air wish you a happy and healthy new year. We'll close with a song from Tom Waits' CD, Blood Money. This is Coney Island Baby.
Every night she comes to take me out to dreamland. When I'm with her, I'm the richest man in the town. She's a rose, she's a pearl, she's a spin on my world. All the stars make their wishes on her eyes. She's my Coney Island baby. She's my Coney Island girl. She's a princess in a red dress. She is the moon in the mist to me. She's my Coney Island baby. She's my Coney Island.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Delta Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Niagara Falls All Over Again by Elizabeth McCracken, author of A Giant's House. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Chris Schiavone knew he was gay when he entered the priesthood. He thought celibacy would make his orientation irrelevant. On the next Fresh Air, we talk about his 8 years as a priest in Boston. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.